You're listening to the Life-Changing Discipleship Podcast. Here's the deal. If you make disciples by sitting around and talking, you shouldn't be surprised when your disciples sit around and talk and talk and talk. This is the podcast for those weary of just talking and ready to start activating in the mission Jesus gave us to change the world. The Life-Changing Discipleship Podcast, where disciples and disciple makers gather to grow and go together. Here's your host, Dr. Matt Friedemann.
Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to our Life-Changing Discipleship Podcast. Great to have you with us today. Very, very excited about today's program. Got a friend on, and he's talking about his new book. Brian Sheldon is professor of theology and dean of Asbury University's School of Christian Studies. Holds a PhD in historical theology from St. Louis University. Spent 2 decades in higher education as both a professor and academic dean. Has a brand new book out. Now, he's got a couple other books, but his brand new book is Theology of a Diary, The 1949 St. Louis Exorcism. Offers a theological assessment of one of the best documented 20th century exorcism cases by closely analyzing the diary of one of the participating priests. Now, I was so taken back by this, but this is the Exorcist story. In other words, this story is behind the popular 1973 film, The Exorcist. And it invites an examination of a diary that we just talked about. And I just am very excited to have this kind of topic done by one of my friends, whom I trust very much theologically. Brian, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you, Matt. And thanks for the great work of Life-Changing Discipleship.
Yeah, well, thank you. Listen, before we get into this, Craig Keener, who I don't know, maybe the leading New Testament scholar in the world. He's certainly the most prolific, but he's got a blurb on your book. Craig Keener from Asbury Theological Seminary says, respectful to the range of Christian theological tradition, Shelton probes both the historical likelihood of details of and theological explanations for the famous 1949 exorcism of this kid, Robbie, which we'll get to him in just a minute. A fascinating exploration of a fascinating incident in history and its theological and practical implications. And Craig Keener says it kept my rapt attention. So not a bad guy to have his attention there, Brian Sheldon. Way to go.
Yeah, thanks. It was an honor, of course, to have him take the time to read the work and, of course, rapt attention.
Now, did you ever see The Exorcist?
I did. I first saw The Exorcist after being a Christian like 9 months. My youth pastor in the 80s decided we should watch a movie, and which movie should we watch? He showed me The Exorcist. Indeed, I shook, like physically scared, because my Christian worldview was just beginning, and I knew that this type of thing in the Bible was possible, and suddenly it's visual, and I was a young Christian. Of course, I've watched it since then for the book.
Well, I don't know how you can watch it again once you've already seen it. My goodness. I mean, I don't know if you know my sister, Lisa, but she was home for the summer. I was on the top bunk. She was on the bottom bunk. And she says, Matt, are you okay up there? I said, I just flat said, I'm not okay. I've seen this movie, The Exorcist. She goes, oh, no. I mean, once you, that thing, and the problem with that, Brian, is if you actually believe in the spiritual world, the demon world, if you actually believe in the devil, then you just don't take those things so lightly as maybe you would if you just don't believe in any of it.
Indeed. It's a powerful effect.
So you call this the best documented 20th century exorcism case, the case that this film is based on. The 1949 St. Louis exorcism. So what makes the documentation unusually strong compared to other accounts like this all over the world?
The primary source. So in 1949, over a 5-week period, these Jesuit priests read the rite of exorcism over this demonized boy. One of the priests kept a day-by-day diary. That diary, of course, was kept low-key. There was a copy in the local diocese, the Archbishop had a copy. There's a couple of Jesuit copies floating around, and the Alexian Brothers Hospital, where the exorcism ended or took place, they had a copy. Well, after the event was done, they sealed off the room, and then eventually, just out of normal operations, they sealed off the wing. Fast forward to the late 1970s, St. Louis is tearing down the hospital. So a regular worker's going room to room, just cleaning out the furniture and things. And he stumbles upon this room that hasn't been touched since 1949.
Wow.
He opens a drawer, and there is a copy of this day-by-day diary of one of the exorcists. Within 20 years, that copy of the diary in 2000 goes public. And so for the first time, this story behind the blockbuster was kind of made available from the perspective of the priests from a day-by-day diary.
So what is your interest in this? You went to school in St. Louis. Is that how you ran into all this, or just what is your personal interest in it?
Indeed. The book arose, first of all, from a desire to tell the story behind the blockbuster, The Exorcist. It's a fascinating tale of a demonized boy, priest in prayer, and a seeming victorious exorcism. At the center are the St. Louis University priests. And yes, I am a St. Louis U grad, and I knew that the story has a legacy of its own. In fact, the university often profiles this event in its alumni magazines and on radio and things. But second, accompanying the story element, Matt, was a desire to demonstrate a historical case for the church that looked like the New Testament stories of demonization and exorcism. I thought if God's people had more solid cases of demonization, then it could diminish the notion that the New Testament stories are mere mental illnesses or social metaphors of bondage from a pre-modern era. Instead, they're real.
Boy, and it happens a lot in the New Testament. I don't know how many times exactly, 8, 9, 10, maybe a dozen times where you see demon possession and folks having to deal with it, do something with it. And I don't know about you, Brian. I'm just figuring my personal way to read the Bible is if it happened back then, it is probably happening today.
Mm. Exorcism is a key dimension of Jesus' healing ministry, right? We almost think of his teaching, preaching, and his miracles, healing. Exorcism's right at the center of that, as well as the identity of early Christianity. Indeed, the devil then, the devil now, just as the Lord then and the Lord now.
Mm. So let's go through the basic contours of this 1949 St. Louis case. I know you got a whole book on this, so I'm sorry to do this to you, but can we put it into a nutshell? This Robbie, what happened? And, you know, we don't want to turn it into sensationalism, but this is kind of a sensational story.
It's powerfully sensational. And of course, what you do with it can be more real or more sensational, but the real part of it is sensational. So in 1949, there was a 13-year-old boy in Georgetown, the suburb of D.C., an only child who loved his aunt Tilly. Indeed, the boy gets the pseudonym Robbie over the years, Robbie Mannheim, Robbie Doe, Roland Doe. Well, his favorite aunt passes away, and so he seems to be lonely. And he does, in his loneliness, the very thing that his aunt, a spiritist, taught him to do, and that was to communicate with the dead. So he got his Ouija board that she taught him to use, and he reached out to her. It led to some manifestations in the house. It led to footsteps. It led to scratching. Eventually, these sounds moved toward the boy's room, toward the boy's bed. Meanwhile, his behavior began to change. And the family, family didn't know. They weren't particularly spiritual. And so they didn't know how to handle or address these things. You know, they called an exterminator because they thought it was the rats in the walls. But eventually, the boy's behavior becomes erratic. And it's as if in space, the demons are moving toward the boy to possess him. First time we're going to use that word. So the boy does some things that look like self-harm. scratches on his body. But the family says, we saw his hands away from his body as these scratches began to manifest themselves from within on his body. They call a Lutheran priest. They call a Catholic priest. They go to physicians. They go to Georgetown University Hospital. They get nothing to help the boy. So they relocate to St. Louis with some family, hoping a change of venue would change things. And it doesn't. The boy's behavior and these demonic manifestations, which should include, by the way, some bizarre, unexplainable phenomenon, things moving across the room, the knocks on the walls. And so a cousin, Elizabeth, is a student at St. Louis U, and she reaches out to her Jesuit priest professor and invites him to come to the house to minister to Robbie. And when he does, eventually it leads to the archbishop approving the reading of the rite of exorcism because the case was proven to qualify as demonization. So over the next 5 weeks, these priests came out in the evening. They had to keep their day job, fulfill their duties. They couldn't tell anyone, so they would clandestinely go out at night and pastorally pray with the boy, read the rite of exorcism, coach the family, and then sometimes go home at 3 a.m., 5 a.m., wake up the next day for their duties. Eventually, this leads to what seems to be a successful exorcism with some climactic manifestations, struggling with the demons. There's a lot of graphic material in the story, but in the end, it does seem to be a successful exorcism to which the church can say, praise the Lord.
So Robbie and his family, did they have a relationship with the church prior to the Jesuit priests?
One parent was Lutheran. One was formerly Catholic. It's fascinating. One of the things the priests record in the diary is the faith of the parents. To try to get, right, you value discipleship in the home, to try to get a background profile of where this boy is spiritually. They are nominally Christian at best. In fact, they seem to be in the paranormal, Matt. You know, as Christians, we believe that the occult kind of opens a gateway to the spiritual, makes a person vulnerable. And the Old Testament is very clear on that. The family, unfortunately, participates in the occult activity because they believe that Aunt Tilly is actually communicating through the boy, scratches on his body, knocks on his wall. So they do seances in the house to try to find out what Tilly's trying to tell them. The parents actually believe that she has left some money hidden in the house and that she's trying to tell them where the treasure is buried. That's a snapshot of the spirituality of the family.
Wow. So you're looking at this theologically, which I very much appreciate, because again, I will tell those in the audience, I trust Brian theologically. I appreciate him. The Jesuit priests, do you think they took the right approach? I know hindsight's, you know, maybe hindsight's not 20/20 here, but we can look back at that, and looking back at it, did they do the right thing?
I think in the end, we have to say yes. I mean, first of all, we and your audience trust you theologically also. I think that's it's an important foundation component. Yeah. Second of all, I think this is part of the tension and part of the study of the book. It's a Catholic worldview. It's Catholic perspective recorded in the diary. They are Catholic priests reading a Catholic rite of exorcism. As Protestants, in fact, the book is written from a Protestant perspective. I think it's ironic and I think it's fair. But naturally, as a Protestant writer, I'm questioning some things Catholic, greater than just the priests in this story. But for the priests in the story, you like to think that maybe if they relied on the mediation of the Lord more directly than the mediation of angels and saints, perhaps their prayers might have been more effective. Those are some of the things the book explores. But in the end, there's faith, there's Christ-centeredness, and there is deliverance from a demon. And so it's hard to say they were entirely wrong. It might be that God simply had mercy on their act of faith, kind of like the friends of the paralytic who persevere to lower their friend through the roof to Jesus.
Right.
Or the blind man who simply says, I don't know, Matt. All I know is I once was demonized and now I am free.
First off, kudos for whoever, the Jesuit priest, for confronting the situation. I've never done that. I've never seen a situation where I thought it should have been done, but I'm not sure I would have done that in their shoes. Yeah. I don't think I would, here's the great without courage cop out. I don't think I would approach it liturgically. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I approach it, but I guess I've seen enough Protestants and maybe enough Charismatics and Pentecostals to think there's another approach I would take rather than reading out of a text.
Well, one of the interesting things about the book is it does introduce the reader to this liturgy because most of us are unfamiliar with it. It's interesting that Hollywood loves Catholic exorcism more than it loves Protestant exorcism, right? When we might pray for someone spiritually, the most outward motion we might offer is a laying on of hands and maybe a bowed head and maybe some elevation in our voice and dramatic moments of the prayer, but otherwise it's spiritual, right? But for a liturgical person, there's going to be the making of the sign of the cross. There's going to be a reading back and forth between two people praying in agreement, the reading of responsively of the liturgy. There are holy symbols also at work, right? There's holy water that can be cast on the subject. And so the outwardness is a little bit fancier. And so I think that's why Hollywood likes it. But nonetheless, the liturgy does contain prayers. It does claim the authority of Christ. There are dramatic moments. There's powerful rebukes to Satan that you just can't help but say amen to and maybe clench and shake your fist at the devil.
Hmm. You describe the ordeal as 3 months of daily struggle. So kind of what does that length reveal about the pastoral reality of this kind of spiritual warfare?
Mm. That brings the book to the relevance for the church in one way. And a lot of your listeners, of course, are pastoral. So that's a great question. I think this helps to demonstrate Jesus' words that some types don't go out except by prayer and fasting. We tend to look at the New Testament episodes of deliverance by Jesus, and it has a sense of immediacy to it, as also do his healings. But it's curious that a lot of these healings aren't formulaic, right? The blind man with the mud and the spit, the lepers go and present yourself to the priest. And even Jesus' words that his disciples are going to have to persevere sometimes in exorcism. This case study helps to demonstrate the non-immediate types of pastoral ministry, that it takes some commitment, it takes time, it takes travel to the house, it takes coaching, pastoral coaching and explanation of what might be going on to the victim. To the one being ministered to and discipled. By the way, pastorally, it's worth noting that these types of situations, they're not just discipleship, but they also can be disciple-making.
Mm.
Next state over from here, I have a friend who, because of the book and knew the project was coming out, gave me a phone call, and he had someone who seemed demonized come to his church and eventually led to the pastoral staff praying for the young man. And last we spoke, there was disciple making going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's how Jesus seems to use it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. You do have the situation in front of you. We need to deal with this situation, but the disciples are being made in the exorcisms or in the dealing with the spirit world.
And the Gadarene passage is the great example of that.
Oh my goodness. What a passage. Yeah. So listen, this theology of a diary. And by the way, we're talking with Brian Shelton here, professor and dean at Asbury University School of Christian Ministries. But we're speaking about his book, Theology of a Diary, the 1949 St. Louis Exorcism, the case behind, apparently, the inspiration for the 1973 movie, The Exorcist. You say theology of a diary. That means some theology ought to come to the fore here. And I know, again, the whole book's about this, so it's a little bit of an unfair question. But this ought to really tell us something about evil, about man, and about God. And when I say man, I mean humans, but about evil and about personhood and humans and about God. What were fresh realizations for you as you went through this case and began discovering things?
When it comes to man, biblical anthropology, we are reminded in the story of the wonder that is life, that God made us. He made us in his image. And it really helps you appreciate the commitment of these priests pastorally to this young boy, right? The boy has worth. Likewise, doctrine of sin, as you watch the boy and the family engage in occultic activities and they wonder why there's a demon unrecognizable, why there these types of things are happening, these demonic manifestations. Evil, indeed, indelibly, that there is evil in the world, that Satan is real. It's not just a metaphor for bad things or when people act badly. But in fact, this exorcism story, as our Christian walk, is participation in a larger theater of God against all things that are against God and his original design. In this case, it is Christians coming face to face with evil in a climactic way. And God, indeed, hope that God would deliver, prayers to God, begging God. By the way, trying to figure out the nature of the demon and why, what this boy has done that he would be demonized is a whole fascinating dimension in the diary that the priests believe that they have the authority by the church to require the demon to confess what his name is and when he will depart. And so the demon will give a message and the priests try to interpret it. And it's really a distraction is what it seems to be. Because they're trying to analyze all of this. But in the end, they're relying on God, and God seems to deliver the boy from demonization. And in the end, you just can't help but rejoice and want to believe even more in the power of the living God.
Well, today, Brian, how do we distinguish demonization, oppression, possession in a way that's responsible and not just driven by headlines or fear or by some movie back in the 70s. How do we deal with this today?
A theology of spirit beings. This is an important part of the Christian life. We don't want to overdo it, right? There's a kind of fringe of the church that it becomes really interested in spirit beings enough to give us the metaphor demon behind every tree, right? But the biblical topic deserves attention as angels and demons intersect with God's people. And so the church needs a theology of spirit beings. It helps us to understand the world. It helps us to understand, you know, encounters in life a little bit. I think a healthy theology, reading good books on the topic, for example, not reading bad books on the topic, but it helps us to appreciate a balance of the presence of God supernaturally in the world, while also living the natural life of obedience and commitment and holiness, that these aren't two separate spheres, but these actually are the sphere in which we live. When it comes to demons themselves, you know, the New Testament uses a noun and a verb, demon and demonization and demonizing. And that word is kind of inclusive. Sometimes Christians fall too quickly into the categories of oppression versus possession, as if there's a fine line in between. Lots of times, pastors or Christians will simply encounter someone who's influenced by a demon more or less. I would just caution your listeners not to be too quick to categorize if those categorizations result in a too deep of analysis, when in reality, it's hard to understand the nature of demons, the effect of demons on a demonized person, and exactly what's going on.
Okay, let's just say someone comes to me, I'm a pastor, which I am, I'm a professor, which I am, and they say, this guy's got a problem, you need to do something about it. I go check it out, and I'm thinking, I think there kind of is a problem here. How do I proceed?
Assuming your theology of demons helps you to recognize well that this really does seem to be something, how one proceeds is, I think it's important to make sure that there is a pastor present and understanding the person and discipling and praying with the person. There's an important element, and the book brings it out in 1949, that demons can hurt people. So there's an important safety precaution which ought to be taken, not just hurting the victim, the one demonized, but in the Catholic rite of exorcism, there's a prayer that the people in the room would be protected by the power of God, because, right, demons beat people up, even in the New Testament. And so there needs to be a physical space awareness to take place in all of this. Certainly the biblical Matthew 18 principle, where two or three are gathered. So a team, two or three wise, respected people, praying and maybe coaching a main discipler in this process. But I would simply say to have people come to the church to be able to talk with a person who may be demonized, pray with that person, have good prayers, have focused prayers, keep an awareness of how the person is responding in prayer. Particularly demonic manifestations sometimes are responses to sacred objects, which again, in a Catholic perspective, right, they've got holy water and they may have a relic and they're watching for that response. For Protestants, right, it's talking about Jesus and watching weird responses. Those can be symptoms of a warped view or an obsession in mocking God, you know, to watch those symptoms to reinforce it. But in the end, you have to decide whether you're praying for exorcism or not. And it's a conscious decision, and that helps to shape, like a Likert scale, whether this is regular discipleship or whether this is spiritual warfare deliverance.
I think if I'm the person that's that has the demon, if someone tells me I have a demon, I'm going to be highly offended. When people are possessed and they're told, hey, we're about ready to exorcise a demon out of you, what how does that make people feel? Typically, in your research, if you're the victim, in other words, what's how are you processing this?
Well, if they've watched The Exorcist, it's not going to make them feel very good.
Right.
I think we do use important language, right? We soften things when we minister. So you might explain a spirit being, you might explain demonization. You might explain, we're going to pray for you this way. You might explain, sometimes what happens is there's a kind of wrestling match between us, not physical wrestling necessarily, but a spiritual wrestling is going to take place. This could be hours. This could be multiple sessions. We're going to try to finish strong and finish well each time. And we're going to pray for you in between. And we've got these other steps. You just lay out clearly what types of prayer and what types of ministry will be taking place. Indeed, you probably won't say we're going to cast a demon out of you through exorcism, but you might use those words alongside using some softer, more careful language of deliverance, prayer, healing, and the Holy Spirit refilling the heart of a believer.
In a typical pastoral life, how many times will a pastor run into this kind of thing? I know that's a crazy question, but still, if you're going to live pastorally in North America or just in the Western world, is this kind of thing going to happen to you pretty for sure? I mean, you're going to face this somewhere.
Probably rarely in America, in the West, right? This is one of the phenomena that seems to be taking place. A really good book, and I know you're aware of this, Joy Vaughn's recent book, Phenomenal Phenomena, compares lots of cultures across the globe where there's more or less supposed demon activity, and she matches it to the Luke Acts in Scripture. Matches them up, by the way. You know, it seems that in the majority world, there's a lot more testimony among pastors of demonic activity, of manifest and deliverance. You know, here in the West, if Satan shows up right in the church and scares people, then people might repent. In a different culture, in a different context, that same thing will paralyze people. So in the strategy of Satan, it may manifest himself less in some of our churches. So I would say generally, rarely, although pastors can keep an eye, watch out for, but I would say when it comes to diagnosing demonization, it's not the thing you're looking for in this case, like you might be looking for depression or you might be looking for anxiety. This is the type of diagnosis that jumps out at you. Things are too weird. Things are too warped. Things are too abnormal that the evidence suggests demonization rather than the pastor have a list of options, and demonization is one of them.
The book's by Brian Shelton. It's called Theology of a Diary, the 1949 St. Louis Exorcism. Of course, the case stands inspiration, I guess, for the movie The Exorcist in 1973. By the way, 1973, it couldn't have been that long. we're getting older. What did the popular retelling get right, and what did it just badly, badly distort? And I know movies from Hollywood take lots and lots of liberties.
Sure.
Generally speaking, what did they get right, and what is probably harmfully distorted?
A fascinating question. Particularly those who have seen the movie, right, can help link the real-life story to it. What they got right, that the occult is a way to invite the demonic into one's life, that one does have to have a measure of faith and have a Christian worldview to understand the dynamics of this and to hope in God for deliverance. The pastors have a key role in this type of ministry to a family and to a victim. They got right that demons can be violent beings and that from time to time, abnormal, unexplainable, preternatural is the word we use. Supernatural is usually God. Preternatural is non-natural phenomenon that they do take place around this. The movie captured that and captured it well. By the way, the demons don't come out easy. What they didn't get right, by the way, it's interesting. William Peter Blatty, the author and advisor on The Exorcist, actually was in dialogue with The Exorcist himself. And the real-life Catholic priest kept saying, don't disclose the identity of the boy. Protect the identity of the boy. The Catholic Church did really well, which is one of the fascinating things. The boy died about 4 years ago now, Matt.
Wow.
And so his identity is out. And so where is he now makes you look back on this event. It's a fascinating story of his life, the result of his life. Nonetheless, in terms of the movie, I forgot my great point, and I forgot it in the middle of your podcast. And that is a shame. Does that happen with podcasters from time to time?
This is going to be award-winning, and you let me get
forward. Award-winning. Yes, they protected the identity of the boy. They made it a girl. And by the way, of course, haunted girls can be a little bit scarier even sometimes. What they didn't get right, indeed, the big climax of the movie is the junior priest gets so frustrated after the demon has slain the older, mature priest. And so he invites the demon into himself, a Christ's Messiah figure. And the demon exits the girl, enters the priest, and the priest throws himself, or the demon casts him through the window. The priest dies, and the demon exits, and the little girl lives somewhat happily ever after. Not a biblical notion, not to be done at home, not in the book and not in the real life story.
So you're telling me that this story of Robbie on into adulthood exists out there? There's a book that retells all that?
There's not a book that retells it. The boy does not remember. There were a couple of journalists over the decades who found him, and he said, I don't recall. It's interesting. He'd stay on the phone with them, but say, I don't know anything. I'm not going to talk about it. But there was some slightly lingering conversations. Indeed, the result of the end of his life and a question of his career and his mental health, questions of family and a healthy lifestyle, these become available to us in the the early 2020s because his identity comes out. And if he was mentally ill in 1949, you might expect that mental illness to perpetuate through his life. In fact, I can leave this as a hook for the book, or I can tell you the results of where he was at the end of the life. Which would you like, Matt?
Are you kidding? We want you to spill the beans. Come on.
In the end, I would say it is a sign of health that Ronald Hunkler, his real name, which also is now out, went on, lived out west, had a family. I think he was divorced eventually, but he went on to be a scientist at NASA and has patents on the fireproofing of spacecraft.
Oh, my goodness.
He literally was a rocket scientist, which cognitively is a sign of health, I think. He worked for NASA for decades. And so he did seem to go on and have a mentally healthy life and a non-demonized life in a way that looks back that 1949 was something irregular, something peculiar, even in the life of Ronald Hunkler.
Was there any clue about his faith?
The diary has an entry at the end about his faith. He is baptized Catholic. During the wrestling matches of the exorcism period, he is baptized. And by the way, the demon's resisting that as he's resisting the Lord's Supper. He does seem to have a nominal Catholic life to follow, however, and also his parents become Catholic. And I did read once that they went on to nominalism, unfortunately, also.
Right. Wow, this is just fascinating. My goodness, Brian, this book ought to go, man, go. This is going to be, I think you're going to enjoy success with this. I really appreciate you. Listen, but to end up our interviews here on Life Changing Discipleship, we like to throw some rapid fire questions, which means you can't take any more than a sentence, and we prefer three or four words if you can do that. Okay, so you ready for the lightning round here?
Yes, sir.
All right. What was the single most surprising detail you found in the diary?
That the priests respected the power of Jesus.
Mm. One myth about exorcism and spiritual warfare you'd love to retire.
That your head can spin around in a 360 fashion and everything be okay.
Your go-to practice for staying spiritually grounded when studying dark material.
Praying a little liturgy like you see in Fighting Dark Material, but with all the lights on.
Mm, beautiful. One book besides your own you'd recommend to listeners who want a sober, theologically serious approach to the demonic.
Clinton Arnold, Three Crucial Questions About Spiritual Warfare.
Mm. Finally, we ask everyone this question unrelated to anything we've just talked about. Just want to get your mind on it. Your recommendation for one thing our listening audience can do today to make a holy difference in the world.
Continue listening to Life Changing Discipleship. Make it applicable into your own world, into your own life, that we fulfill the Great Commission to make disciples.
You're a good friend. All right, my dear friends, it's a wrap. My wife thanks you. My daughter and her husband thanks you. My five sons and their wives thank you. The grandkids thank you. And I can assure you, I thank you for listening to Life Changing Discipleship Podcast today. We want you to love God, live clean, keep the faith. God bless you, my dear friends. We'll see you back here real soon.